From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food.
You know, my perspective on Israeli food is it's about the people and it's about the different cultures that make up Israel. And from a dining perspective and from a culinary perspective, it's so, so stimulating because you've got so many things happening at once. And you've got all this old and all this new, and it's a small country. I mean, it's like the size of New Jersey.
The food world has fallen hard for Israeli cooking as of late, and rightly so. It's a big-flavored, brightly colored, addicting cuisine. Formerly hidden away in insular communities, now some lucky cities, ours included, have chefs making memory and culture available in edible form. Michael Solomonov is one of these chefs. Along with his business partner, Stephen Cook, he opened Zahav in Philadelphia in 2008. And lucky for us, they've given us a beautiful new book of the same name. Hi, Michael.
Hi, how are you?
Good. It's so great to meet you.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
When I first saw the book and I saw the cover, this big, bold, super colorful graphic cover, I thought, wow, it's just a reflection, hopefully, of what's inside. And I was not disappointed. So just to go a little bit into your background, you're American. You grew up an American kid.
Yeah, I was born in Israel, so I've always had, like, you know, two passports. And I grew up in Pittsburgh. I was born in Israel, grew up in Pittsburgh, moved back to Israel, moved back to Pittsburgh, attempted college, went back to Israel, and then back to the States.
I feel like so many people who are really into food, and particularly people who cook at home, have been introduced to Israeli food through Ottolenghi.
Yes.
And his book, Jerusalem, written with Sami Tamimi.
Mm-hmm.
I find your choice at Zahav to differentiate yourself from sort of a pan-Mediterranean cuisine or even a larger Arab cuisine. Mm-hmm. Really interesting, and it seems at the heart of that is this ingredient, tahina.
Yes.
Can you talk about that?
Well, so tahina is, you know, tahina is like the mother sauce that's sort of used often in the Middle East, but especially with Jewish Israeli cooking because it's not dairy, right? So even though people aren't necessarily kosher or they're secular, the use of tahina is sort of like the ultimate meat sauce because it goes with everything. And I think that Israelis and Palestinians in general love the flavor of it. I mean, that bitter, roasty, it works sort of with the Israeli and Palestinian palate. So for us, I mean, when we opened Zahav, we made a choice to be kosher style, not because we are we're open on Fridays and Saturdays. It's not like we're a kosher restaurant, but it was a lot easier to tell the story of Israeli food that way. As a chef, like every time you grill like lamb chops or whatever, you like have the urge to throw yogurt on it, you know, and that's great and it's delicious. But the easiest way to express Israeli cuisine, I think, is through tahina, because you would never, I mean, you'd see that in restaurants in Israel, but it's more natural to serve it with tahina, you know, and even the Balkan restaurant, you know, like the Bulgarian and the Romanian and the European sort of influences in Israel now, you know, even though tahina isn't something that they grew up with or they brought with them, you know, during a sort of post-independence in Israel, tahina has sort of made its way to everything.
So let's like sort of do a deep dive into it. Describe exactly what it is. When we buy that jar of tahina, what is it?
Well, it's typically sesame seeds. We use a brand that gets sesame seeds from Ethiopia. They get shipped to Israel. They get processed in Nazareth. And the processing is usually sort of like a roasting to try to eliminate as much water as possible. And then they sift it, you puree it, you know, mess around with it. It goes through like 25 different, you know, sort of steps. And then you end up with pure sesame butter.
So now we go from the ingredient, the heart of it,
yes,
to the sauce, which every time I make it, I always feel like it's some bizarre magic trick.
It is magic.
Because it seizes up.
It does seize up, right.
And then it just relaxes.
It does. So it's almost like, have you ever added water to chocolate and it seizes? But, you know, you continue to add water, it will turn into like emulsified chocolate sauce. It's like that same thing, you know? I think that a lot of people, and this is the way that we sort of tell the story of hummus, like you're used to taking chickpeas and tahina and garlic or whatever and putting it into a food processor and pressing a button. And like sometimes it's okay or sometimes it looks like, you know, chalky like peanut butter and they have to overcompensate. I think that the making the tahina stable is kind of the secret to everything. And we whip and aerate and add like water to our tchina, and we use that to blend the chickpeas to make our hummus.
Okay, so you said this other word, hummus.
Yes.
But before we go there,
yeah,
I still have some tahina questions.
Yes.
Aside from using it just as a sauce, you also use it as a liaison in the way that chefs have been using dairy, like butter or cream forever.
Of course.
Could you talk a little bit about how you use that?
Well, I think that it can be, you know, you can finish sauces and broths with it. The easiest thing to do is like take whatever pistachios or like we'll use black walnuts in Pennsylvania and puree those and sort of add them to the tchina as well, which is fantastic. And particularly like what, you know, you're pairing with it, like the walnuts and like grilled black bass, you know, just so, so good. And that's nothing we've had in Israel, but it's like the flavor just makes a lot of sense. You can add a little bit more liquid, a little water, lemon juice, and make emulsified dressings, which are awesome too. You don't have to add egg yolks or oil. You've got it all right there. So it's very, very versatile. But, I mean, just as important, just putting raw tchina on, like, toast with date molasses as sort of like the PB&J, you know? It's like what any poor student has ever eaten in Israel, like, three times a day. I mean, it's just so, so important and so delicious and just tastes like sort of being in Israel.
Okay. So hummus.
Yes.
Aside from Zahav.
Yes.
Your marquee restaurant, your big restaurant.
Yep.
You also have a hummusia.
Yeah, we have a little hummus place called Dizengoff. Exactly.
So let's talk about what we're going for. I love the description in the book about when you were working on the hummus.
Yeah.
And you got to this moment where you realized it was right and the room just went dead.
Yeah, well, we have our manager at the time is from Ashdod, which is like the southern coastal town in Israel. And he, you know, we were like eating hummus like over and over and over. And to a certain point, I mean, at a certain point, you're like done. You've got like palate fatigue or whatever. And it was just like, you know, we were like increasing the amount of tchina that we were adding sort of in stages. And we finally got to a place, you know, and he ate it and we were all just kind of new. And yeah, it was like a silent sort of moment. We all had this like very spiritual moment, I think, when we were eating the hummus tchina, and it, you know, brings you back and it's like, you nail it. And it's obviously important. It's probably one of the biggest reasons that people come into the restaurant. But it's also one of those very simple things that people take very seriously. You know, and we get asked all the time, what's the most complicated thing to make? And it's like, well, you know, if you make hummus improperly, there's nothing that you can hide. You can't put stuff on it. You can't do faux caviar. You can't like use garnish to make it taste any different. It just has to be good every single day. And making it consistently every single day is probably the most difficult thing to do.
When we make it at home, often we're looking for that elusive silkiness.
Yes.
Instead of that grit.
We don't want grit, yeah.
How do you not get grit?
Well, what we do, and this, you know, obviously is like the way that we have sort of interpreted it. We take chickpeas and soak them in baking soda and then like cook them with more baking soda and get them like super, super, super mushy. And then we press them and drain them overnight. And then we mix it with our tchina sauce that's already been sort of aerated and whipped and it's already kind of moussey. On its own, it's delicious, right? And that way, the chickpea skin's released from the baking soda. It gets really, really soft. So you're not like burning out your motor when you try to make it yourself.
Are you skimming off the skins?
No, I mean, you will. If there's skim and sort of foam at the top, you can skim that off. I know a lot of people say they peel the chickpeas. You can also purchase peeled chickpeas. You know, we have got a 100-seat restaurant, so we cannot peel all those chickpeas. We just don't, you know, we don't have an army of people that can peel chickpeas, and the way that we do it, I think, is effective.
There's so many different ways that you serve it. You have how many different styles?
At Dizengoff, we've got about 5 different sort of, like, toppings. And at Zahav, we have about 3, but then we also serve a sort of like warm, buttered, sort of Turkish style. In the colder regions of Turkey, they use butter and they serve it hot, which is almost sounds like it could be cheating, but it's not. It's legit.
It sounds so insane.
Yeah, so good.
It's the kind of book where I just want to go page by page, cook through every recipe.
Awesome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Chef Michael Solomonov. Along with Stephen Cook, he co-authored Zahav, A World of Israeli Cooking. We've got a recipe and we've got an outtake on the blog. Check it out. It's a fall dish that I can't wait to make. Pumpkin broth with my favorite fideos. It's time for our weekly visit from Jonathan Gold, the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times. Today, we're headed to Broken Spanish, the latest project from Chef Ray Garcia. Jonathan says the menu is Ray's version of Mexican food, and he's here to tell us exactly what that means.
It means that there are very few things that are going to be on his menu that you're likely to have had at almost any other place.
Okay, so is he doing Mexican food seen through a contemporary lens, or is this certain regional stuff? Is it family, personal stuff? All of the above?
It's a little bit inchoate. I mean, I keep thinking of it in terms of Chicago, and you have Rick Bayless has Topolobampo, which is his serious place that, for example, like serves you jicama instead of tortilla chips and has, you know, tasting menus, as opposed to Frontier Grill, his place next door, which is every bit as respectful of Mexican tradition but has the tortilla chips and has the beer and has, you know, everything that you'd associate it with it. So Garcia, after he left Fig to take this new modern Mexican direction, opened BS Taqueria, which we talked about here a few months ago. That is the fun place, and this is the serious place.
I mean, just because the food is more serious doesn't mean that's not fun, right?
That's true.
I mean, you could start out with a great cocktail, I'm assuming.
You can definitely start out with a great cocktail. The most interesting one, I think, is the cazuela, which is this sort of big, ornate clay vessel filled with, mezcal and tequila and pineapple juice and chilies and some other stuff that two people share.
So that's a good way to start off. And what kind of appetizers would you pair with that?
They have a few different botanas. The most obvious way to start here is with the tortillas, which they charge for. They use a special kind of blue corn that's actually brought up from Mexico and nixtamalized by Carlos Salgado from Taco Maria in Orange County. They serve them with either refried lentils pounded into a paste or whipped carnitas fat, which is exactly what it sounds like.
So kind of like lardo. That must be so good.
It's very porky. Very nice.
Okay.
And they call them botanas, which are plates made to drink with. And there's ripe mission figs served with like a little black sesame paste, corn with kewpie mayonnaise, or little sandwiches, molletes, spread with smashed peas where you might expect the bean paste in most people's molletes, and flavored with yerba buena, which is, kind of mint, very close to spearmint, I think.
So is this menu an a la carte menu, or is this a tasting option?
It's very much a sharing menu. I think everything is meant to be shared. So you go through those things. You go through, I guess you could call them first courses, which include like a pollo prensado, which is a version of one of my favorite Mexico City dishes. The original is, you take all the schmutz from the bottom of the pot when you're making carnitas, and then you press it together and slice it into this sort of horrible yet completely delicious jelly.
Yeah, it's like a differently weird version of head cheese in
right.
a way. So, but a chicken version must be great. So it's like schmaltz based.
There's definitely chicken fat in there, and there's meat from chicken thigh, and there's skin probably from all parts of the chicken. And theoretically, there are coxcombs in there, though I've never actually run across a coxcomb. Don't make that face, Evan. Coxcomb is a really interesting, good part of the chicken.
Okay.
It is actually really hard to find anywhere here.
What a surprise.
And if you're staying on the exotic side, you can get green beans, which come with a poached egg on top, and also pounded grasshoppers.
Oh, that's nice.
Because who doesn't want grasshoppers on the green beans.
I love the way they taste.
One interesting thing that he does here is the big plates at the end, which he calls platos principales, which, you know, I guess that just means big plates, right?
Main dish.
My favorite so far is almost laughingly called chicharrón.
Mm-hmm. Why laughingly?
Well, it's basically a porchetta.
Okay.
Yeah, you're thinking of like a few slips of pigskin, either crunchy and fried or like slippery and stewed. But this is, you know, roasted skin on belly with lots of garlic and with a handful of radish sprouts and some herbs. But basically, you're getting a giant slab of fatty meat, and it's a very happy thing. There's, you know, rabbit with bacon, which is delicious, cooked almost like a michiote. And there are certain people who will be unable to go there without ordering the lamb's head.
I love that you saved this for last. So how's the lamb's head presented?
Halved. You get half of a roast lamb's head. There's some pickled onions. You pick off the meat from the head. You put in one of those tortillas and lamb's head.
Thank you so much, Jonathan.
Thank you, Evan.
That was Jonathan Gold, Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times. We've been talking about broken Spanish in the old Rivera space in downtown LA. Text the words good food to 69866, and you will get a text with the restaurant's address and Jonathan's recommended dishes. Coming up, did you know you can make miso paste at home? My next guest says it's easy and totally worth it. Stay close.
This is producer Jillian Ferguson. You can connect with other food lovers on Evan's Facebook page, share photos, ask questions, and meet new friends. Search for Evan Kleinman on Facebook and click like.
Welcome back to Good Food. Japan. It's a fascinating place where modernity meets tradition head on. And in the face of modern pressure, craft has given way to mechanized production. Nancy Singleton Hajisu moved to Japan to teach English for a year. She married a farmer and ended up staying for decades. Her extraordinary new book, Preserving, The Japanese Way, shares a kind of cooking of life, really, that's in danger of slipping away. Hi.
Hello, Evan.
So your life, I would imagine, unfolded in a way that you never could have expected.
Yes and no. My ideal life was always that I would have a little inn in Vermont, and I would have a little garden, and we have the inn, and we're working with my husband, and the kids would be running around someplace, you know. And so it's not in Vermont, but... You know, it kind of happened a bit like that. And plus, the kind of messiness and craziness of the life and the homeschoolingness and all of these odd things. You know, I grew up with sort of a beatnik family in Atherton. And actually, my life is a lot more like it started out to be, like in Palo Alto. And just it's very familiar, I think, in some way, because I just created it.
And a lot of it has to do with this move that you and your husband made to your in-laws' home. So mm-hmm. I feel like that house created this opportunity for you mm-hmm. to learn all this stuff and become sort of like, I think of you as this expat warrior running around gathering traditions from yeah. anyone who right. will talk to you.
Right.
Share a little bit with us about the house and what it means. I feel like it's extremely metaphorical in a way.
Yes. The house is, there's this responsibility to take care of the house and to keep it going. It's an 85-year-old house, I guess, now. It was rebuilt by my husband's grandfather, reusing beams and posts. It's not a fancy farmhouse. There's rice farmers have a little bit more fancy ones. You can sell by the carvings, but... It represents the center of the whole family in some way. You know, it's the honke. It's the main house. And so, actually, my mother-in-law died before I did learn pickling and preserving from her. But, you know, we're really busy. We always think there's time. So now, like you said, I'm gathering the methods and the stories from other people and from my husband's aunt. But yeah, the house, it's the center for our life.
When you decided to throw yourself into preserving, did you discover that there was a robust community of people still doing things in the traditional way, or was it hard?
It was not a robust community, and the people that are doing it, in fact, my farmer friends are not really doing it because they're busy working. And so it's really the people who've come back to that area or have moved from an urban environment, and whether or not they started out in a country, but they've come back, they've relocated to our area. And so they have this renewed verve for let's do it.
Kind of like here, what's happened here with the DIY movement.
Yes, yes. So.
Okay, so let's start actually talking about the preserving itself. There's so much in the book. It's, wow, it's really incredible. But let's start with something that is really simple, mm-hmm. something like salt and massage.
Yeah, right. There's four things that are really simple, and I think this is what's pretty incredible, is there's four salt flavors in Japan, salt, miso, soy sauce, and fish sauce. And just with those, well, simplified, you can make a quick pickle. And pickles, so you just souse it or douse it or massage it, 10 minutes, 20 minutes, 30 minutes max, and you have a delicious bite that can go with most meals or with drinks or whatever. So you get these preserved products. Salt's not preserved, but it's artisanally produced. And then you can have this, you get the beautiful vegetable and it's done.
So give us an example of one. You don't have to go into it in great detail, but just...
My favorite is celery, cut a little bit thick, and then you soak it for 30 minutes in half dashi and half fish sauce with a little red pepper, and it's absolutely one of the most delicious things you've ever tasted.
There was one recipe that I thought was so interesting because it seemed rather easy, and I was intrigued by the way you said you could make them and hold them. A shiso leaf that was stuffed with miso.
Yeah.
Which seems like way too strong to even be able to eat.
Right. This is a really cool little recipe that just barely made it into the book. And I learned it from this 100-year-old woman who, a grandma, great-grandma of this incredible ironworks factory. And she survived the tsunami. Kind of an incredible story. But she mixes sugar and walnuts in with miso and maybe a little bit of salt and maybe a little bit of hot pepper. And I cut the amount of sugar that she said. And you roll it up in the shiso leaf, and then you saute it in the pan. And then you stick it in Tupperware, because shiso is in the summer. She says it's a good little bite whenever you don't have anything to eat, that you can just like take it out of the fridge, and it's good for like months, 6 months or so.
Wow.
Right?
Sounds so good.
It's actually really delicious, yeah.
And I know that you make your own miso.
I really encourage people to make miso. You're talking about the most simple thing, and it's almost fail-proof. I treat my miso so poorly. It's steamed soybeans, rice koji, easily attainable, salt, and a little bit of starting miso. I stirred my miso twice this summer. Twice. You're supposed to stir it every week, blah, blah, blah. Still delicious. Really, it's so easy. And to make it by yourself is way better than the commercial one you can find in the States.
I just want to thank you for this book. It's so much more than a collection of recipes. It really is a window into a type of life and a richness of a culture.
Well, thank you. And what really I wanted to focus on or to showcase in this book was the artisans. I'm just so deeply thankful that they are there doing it so that we can have those products.
Are they passing down to a new generation?
A lot of them are, yeah. And so that's also very exciting.
Well, thank you so much, Nancy.
Thank you, Evan.
Nancy Singleton Hachisu lives the Japanese farm life in rural Japan. We've been talking about her latest book, Preserving the Japanese Way. We've got a recipe for her shiso rolls with miso and walnuts on the Good Food blog.
Mm-hmm.
let's head over to the Santa Monica Farmers Market to find out what's in season on our local farms. Laura Avery's there with her weekly update.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. It's that time of year when farmers are starting to harvest their walnuts and pecans, so there is an order to this. We're talking now with Scott Peacock from Dinuba, and Scott has walnuts in shell, and you've also got walnuts shelled in a bag. You've also got your pecans and your almonds. But Scott, tell us now, right now is the time when you're harvesting walnuts. How do you know when they're ready to harvest?
Well, for us, we're just a small walnut producer. I have a row of walnuts at the end of my persimmon orchard, so there's probably 35 or 36 walnut trees. So we're not a commercial operation. The commercial guys, when they're ready, they go out and harvest them with their machinery and pick them up and take them to a huller, and it's a very involved process. For us, we wait till the husks open up, and when they start to drop out of the tree, we know they're ready, and we go out with a long pole and knock them out of the tree. Pick them up off the ground after they've been knocked out of the tree, put them on a trailer out in the sun for a day or two, and then they're ready to go.
But then how do you get that green husk off?
The husk opens, yeah. And it stays in the tree, or it stays on the ground. So we don't use any mechanism to take the husk off.
Okay, then you put the brown walnut shell, whole walnuts in your trailer just to dry?
We just set it out in the sun for a day or two to make sure that the kernel is dry, and then we bag them up and bring them to the market.
That's it? No roasting? No dry roasting?
Nothing like that. It's a very, very natural product. And so we've got two varieties. I have a Hartley, which is an old, old, old variety, and a Tehama. And we're harvesting our Tehamas now, and the Hartleys are going to be in about 2 or 3 weeks. They're starting to break open now.
How big are the trees?
Well, some of these trees are probably 50 feet high, so they're very, very big trees.
So how do you get that pole up there and knock those top?
Oh, we get a long pole and have a guy that climbs up a 10-foot ladder and hammers away.
So how many pounds of walnuts do you get from one 50-foot tree?
It depends on the health of the tree, but there's 300 or 400 pounds per tree.
And then how much care do you give the trees during the year? Are they pruned, topped?
You know what we do is we kind of shape the tree every 2 or 3 years, and then we irrigate, and that's basically it. They're easy to take care of.
Do they take a lot of water?
Walnut trees are there at the end of my persimmon orchard, so when I irrigate my persimmons, the walnuts get a drink as well.
Right. So you only sell walnuts whole, but you do have some shelled. Who does the shelling?
You know what I do, I have a neighbor that has a sheller, or cracker, we call it, and when I get them all accumulated and dried and ready to go, I take a few batches over and he runs them for me.
That's neighborly.
That's good. Yeah, good for both of us.
All right, Scott. Thank you so much. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
That was Scott Peacock. He's a farmer from Dinuba. He grows a variety of things, persimmons, several kinds of nuts, great eggplant, you know, in the fall, and telling us being neighborly as a small farmer and how to get those walnuts off the tree. Talking now with David Thorne, who is the chef owner of Elysian. And David, you're here every week shopping, and Elysian is a little bit non-conventional as restaurants go. So tell us a little bit about what Elysian is and what your program is.
Okay. Elysian started out as an event venue because it's a large warehouse in Elysian Valley. And now we're sort of trying to shift the balance, and we offer dinner service on Thursdays and Friday nights and brunch on Sundays.
And Elysian, what is the name from?
The neighborhood that we're in is called Elysian Valley. It's kind of this little triangle between the two, the 110 and the 5. It's an isolated pocket that not a lot of people know about, but it's sort of getting on the gentrification map at the moment. So,
what are you shopping for? I see your cart's got a whole bunch of eclectic items.
Yeah, we have a lot. The menu's about 12 items, all, you know, small plate style. So this week I'm getting a little bit of okra and some sweet peppers for a lamb dish. We're doing a gnocchi, a parsnip gnocchi, with beef cheek and beet greens and these fresh red onions, like the ones that are not really dried and ready to go into storage. They have a different flavor, kind of lovely.
So do you make up your mind on Wednesday what you're going to serve over the weekend?
No, we're trying to have kind of a more or less set menu with things that change every week. So maybe two dishes will change each week. You know, we were running a tomato and melon salad, and this, that sort of season is coming to a close. So we're shifting the salads into a smoked trout and dandelion green roasted beet salad.
Sounds fabulous. Sounds so seasonal and just what we like to do here. How do people get reservations?
Either through our website or through OpenTable. Or you can just show up.
All right. Well, thank you for pointing that out. And the menu sounds fabulous.
Thanks.
That was David Thorne. He's chef owner at Elysian. He does a wonderful seasonal California menu. And we love him so much. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Are you following us on Instagram yet? Find us at KCRW Good Food. And we'll keep you up to date on what's in season each week in Southern California. It's like having your own little shopping list. Have you ever pretended to be allergic to something at a restaurant just so it didn't end up on your plate? A recent report says allergy fakers are real and rampant, and it's wreaking havoc on restaurant kitchens. Find out how some chefs are coping when Good Food returns.
Good Food is produced by KCRW, a listener-supported public radio station in Los Angeles, California. Support our programming by making a donation. Go to kcrw.com/join.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. Have you ever pretended to be allergic to something at a restaurant just so it didn't end up on your plate? If so, you are not alone. And ironically, as chefs struggle to accommodate more diner requests, risks to those with actual life-threatening allergies is increasing. Neil Swidey's article in Boston Globe magazine, Why Food Allergy Fakers Need to Stop, is a fascinating look at how the behavior of many is changing chefs' ability to cater to a few. We called him to find out more. Hi, Neil.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. I guess before we get into the meat of this discussion, so to speak, we should probably say outright that our conversation isn't aimed at that small percentage of us who have life-threatening food allergies.
That's absolutely right. I mean, people who have food allergies, for them, it is a life and death situation, and those are real. And what I wanted to do with this article was to open people's eyes about the great progress we've made for people who have life-threatening allergies and genuine disease that's affected by food, but also make the point that that progress is not guaranteed, and that we're starting to see now, because of these fakers and people phrasing their preferences in the form of an allergy, that those accommodations are more vulnerable than I think people might be aware.
You know, it's really interesting when I read your article, because I feel like my personal trajectory as a chef and the life of my restaurant was sort of mirrored the exact trajectory where we went from being completely unaware of food allergies and how horrific they can be to the pressure to create a nearly clinic-like response to a last-minute request.
Exactly, Evan. I think that's the point here. That it wasn't that long ago. In fact, I begin with essentially patient zero in the mid-1980s, where a young college student at Brown University goes in to a Tex-Mex restaurant, orders chili, and dies after two bites. That made people aware of just how precarious the restaurant can be for people who have these life-threatening allergies. And then over the next 10 years, people became aware, and there were a lot of small but very powerful, resourceful efforts to make restaurateurs and others aware of just how serious this was for people. And so it became an issue of restaurants needed to disclose what was in their food and be mindful of that life or death situation for a small percentage of their customers. So fast forward to where we are today, where we got all those accommodations, and people have, I think, in most places, a very high confidence when they go into a reputable restaurant that their allergies and other disorders are going to be taken seriously if they're related to food. But now it's gotten so prevalent that on any given night in any restaurant, you know, up to 50 or even in some places 60% of the tables will have someone who says, I have an allergy, which triggers an enormous sort of protocol in the back in the kitchen to make sure there's no cross-contamination. But then you see that only a fraction of those are actually legitimate allergies. Most people are just have a dietary preference and they want to make sure it's heard, so they tell a little white lie.
So let's back up a bit. How many of us have real food allergies? Do we know?
So the most reputable studies for adults, American adults, is about 4% of us have food allergies. But there's some clinical studies that have shown about 30% of us believe we have food allergies. That's not people faking it. That's people who just essentially self-diagnose. I must be allergic to this because I have had a bad reaction, so I must have a food allergy. So that's a big gap just there. And then on top of that, you have the people who are just kind of wrapping themselves in the packaging of allergy, using that word very loosely when it really is a dietary preference.
And one of the stories you tell in your article is something that I saw very often in my own restaurant, which is someone would say they can't have any dairy, for example. And so the kitchen would go out of their way to make sure that things were either made specially for them or the waiter would guide them through the menu to make sure that they chose something that was dairy-free. And then in the end, they would have ice cream.
Exactly. And I can't tell you how many restaurants have had that same experience that you've had. And that's be okay if it was just a little white lie and people were telling that and there was really no consequence beyond that. But it's not that, because the restaurants, for liability issues and for just moral issues, have to treat any time a customer says allergy as though that could be a life-threatening allergy, meaning that all the sauté pans have to be swapped out, all the cutting boards have to be swapped out, all the tongs have to be swapped out, all to avoid cross-contamination, because if you have a life-threatening allergy, just a smidge of that food stuff that you're allergic to could throw you into anaphylactic shock or worse. So they can't, you know, roll the dice and assume that, you know, some percentage of these are going to be fake so we can just go more easily with them. But then if you're doing that 20, 30, 40 times a night on a busy Saturday night when you don't have time is what you don't have in most busy restaurants, and then you see that, or you see people saying, I have a gluten allergy, even though gluten intolerance isn't really an allergy, but people phrase it that way. And then they order a beer or dig into their date's brownie dessert and say, it's okay if I cheat a little bit at the very end of this. That's where this pushback is coming from.
And what I find kind of interesting is I think for most folks who really do have who carry EpiPens, who really are at risk, either they go out very infrequently or they go to a restaurant over and over where they have a special relationship and the chef knows that it's a serious thing. Because I think on the bottom of most restaurant menus, it should be what's printed on that bag. You know, this food was prepared in a location that has nuts, flour, dairy, et cetera. And for small places, it's almost impossible not to have a little bit of cross-contamination.
I think that's exactly right. And so what I would mention, though, is I can't tell you the number of chefs who I talked to who told me how thrilled they have been to make it possible for people who never felt they could take the risk to go out to dinner to be able to do that, to live the social life. Most of us who don't have these life-threatening allergies don't realize how much social activity is geared around food and particularly restaurants. And to have people who were denied that be able to participate in life fully that way is a wonderful thing. And so the pushback is not don't ask for accommodations. If you don't like garlic, say keep the garlic off my entree or order something else. But don't say I'm allergic to garlic, because that's a different order of magnitude in terms of the response.
Well, thank you so much, Neil Swiede.
My pleasure. Thank you, Evan.
Neil Swiede is a staff writer at Boston Globe magazine. We have a link to his article, Why Food Allergy Fakers Need to Stop, on my Facebook page. Search for me, Evan Kleiman, and click like. As judicious as we are about eating gluten or dairy, we humans are certainly willing to chow down on some really weird ingredients when they come wrapped in a shiny, convenient wrapper. I mean, what is polysorbate 60? And why is it on the ingredient list for Twinkies? Steve Ettlinger went on a journey to deconstruct the Twinkie when his daughter asked those exact questions. And now he's partnered with photographer Dwight Eshleman to look at a larger world of powders and gums in his new book, Ingredients, a visual exploration of 75 additives and 25 food products. Hi, Steve.
Hello there.
I'm so curious to know how this book came about, because it's so odd. It's, you know, usually you think of like a beautifully photographed coffee table book about food as being sort of a salute to a marvelous chef or a wonderful farm. And this is like a salute to all these strange things we let people put in our food.
Absolutely. It's more than a salute. It's an answer to the question, what the heck is this stuff? We're both, Dwight and I, really curious guys, and we really wanted to see what this stuff looked like. And in my case, I went to see where it was made. I went to factories and mines and so forth. That's what I covered primarily in my prior book. But Dwight has this great way with a camera and lighting. He brought out detail in things like MSG that are really detail that's just amazing to look at.
So there's one ingredient in here that truly fascinates me because for, as you say, time immemorial, we heard stories about the rowan tree or the mountain ash and its special properties to protect against malevolent beings, which seems appropriate this time of year, and ward off bad influences. So what is this magical berry?
It harbors a number of the ingredients that we use now to make preservatives, which ward off malevolent beings, microbes, and what was the other one? Evil, what'd you say?
Evil influences.
Evil influence, which would be spoilage. So it hasn't changed. It won't help you find water. It won't bring you brilliance or love, but it does ward off bad stuff, and it's very potent. And it's found in sorbic acid, which is why you often see that listed at the very end of an ingredient list, because it's there in just a few parts per million. But it's the same stuff, and a lot of indigenous people used to harvest those berries and use them for medicinal purposes. So I can't identify the day when some Western scientist said, ooh, let's watch what these very smart and talented and healthy indigenous people are doing and mimic it in the lab, which, by the way, is how we get a lot of our medicine.
At the very end of the book, there is a breakdown of 25 food products, and it's a photographic breakdown of little dots of the powder so you can get an idea of what's in the food. And my favorite one is Morningstar Farms Original Sausage Patties, which is, of course, something that a lot of people who are vegan or vegetarian turn to get a hit of breakfast sausage. It has 42 of these ingredients from the book.
May I point out that that's three more than the Twinkies have? It's pretty amazing. When you make things on an industrial basis, you have to add ingredients that maybe just help with the processing. For example, if something is being squirted through a tube, like a batter, or I don't know how Morningstar Farms makes their patties, but at one point I'm sure it's piped somewhere, it has to be made into a consistency that flows well in a tube or plops out of a mold easily. If you're making something at home and the stuff doesn't pop out, you just, you know, work at it a little bit. If it leaves a little residue on the pan, you scrape it a little bit. In an industrial environment, you can't scrape stuff. You have to add things that will help it release from a mold or the tube or the kettle or whatever it is. So that's why Morningstar Farms may have to add a lot of ingredients to their seemingly simple patty. They also do it for flavor. You know, they add different flavors and so forth. And sometimes it takes a number of items to create a natural flavor.
I never realized that they put sugar in cement.
Why not? No, it's all chemicals, whether it's food or cement you're pouring. All these things, and that's what they are, they're things, have qualities that can apply in a lot of different areas. It might retard the hardening of the cement or make it glossy. Corn syrup and other things go into rocket fuel, polysorbate 60 in paint. Actually, a lot of polysorbate 60 and its nephews or brothers, polysorbate 80, are in shampoos. It's a goo. Now, we like it in food, or I should say we get it in food, because it's a great egg yolk substitute. It's an incredible emulsifier. But who's to say it wouldn't emulsify paint really well, or for that matter, rocket fuel, which I appreciate eating something that's used in rocket fuel. I think it's hilarious.
Are you aware of the hubbub that happened around the Subway bread the yoga mat material?
Oh, I'm so glad you brought that up. I am hyper aware of it. I must say I discovered it only when researching this. And I was so pissed off at that blogger. Absolutely, I thought it was such a stupid thing to go on and on about something that she called the yoga mat material. Her posts about it and her campaign to get Subway to remove it from their bread had so much wrong with it that it really blew my mind. I'm still putting it back together. The chemical in question is azodicarbonamide, which I love pronouncing, and I taught myself to pronounce because it was one of those things that seemed long and scary. And so I said, you know, I got to get into that. By the way, it's long because in scientific language, every syllable tells you something about how the molecule is constructed. It doesn't mean anything scary. I might add, the fact that she wanted Subway to remove it kind of got to me. Why not say, hey, this is poisonous and this is terrible. It should be removed from the food stream. Right away, that's suspect. Why go after Subway? Why not say, hey, you know, it's dangerous. Then even the blogger herself put out her research after people said, why? You know, how do you find this dangerous? And her research and her supporters' research showed that it was dangerous to the people making it in the chemical in the factory. And why? Because it's a dust. Well, let me tell you, all dusts are dangerous. Flour dust can cause explosions. You can't go into a flour mill without wearing safety gear and being very, you'll see it's very careful, very ventilated very carefully and so forth, because dust is explosive. Why she thought this was bad for you, I don't know. It's an anti-foaming agent. It's used in plastics the same way water is used in paint. You know, it has a lot of purposes, but it had nothing to do at all with your health in bread. And yet Subway had to bow to consumer pressure and take it out. I thought that was one of the stupidest things I ever saw a blogger do, and I'm incensed by it.
So tell me again what it is that it does.
It's an anti-foaming agent, just controls the foam when you're making something that foams. And it's used in just a few parts per million. It disappears after it's cooked. That's why it was so ridiculous, too. Oh, I have to add one thing. That triggered ridiculous comments. I saw another blogger post something with a headline about, there are yoga mats in our food. I mean, come on.
Well, Steve, thank you very much.
You are quite welcome. And now, let's go out and have some Twinkies. Actually, I'm going to go have an apple.
Good choice. That was Steve Ettlinger. Along with photographer Dwight Eshleman, he has given us a fascinating look at the processed additives in our most popular packaged foods. Their book is Ingredients, a visual exploration of 75 additives and 25 food products. Who is the king of LA's Italian dining scene? We'll tell you where to find the very best pasta, deli sandwiches, and more next.
Good Food is produced by KCRW, a listener-supported public radio station. Search for KCRW in the podcast section of iTunes to find other programs like Bookworm, The Treatment, The Business, Unfictional, and DNA. And thanks for listening.
You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. Italian food, pizza, pasta, gelato. We love this food, and no wonder. As children, sucking up that noodle of spaghetti is one of the first pleasures we associate with eating.
The latest issue of Los Angeles Magazine celebrates the very best of Italian food in L.A., from old-school red sauce joints to classic delis. And Dine editor Leslie Barger Suter's here to prove that Los Angeles is not afraid of carbs. Hi, Leslie.
Hi.
So let's start off by talking about where we can dine.
Okay.
There's been a huge shift in Italian restaurants in L.A. in the last 10 years, I'd say. Who are the top now?
Sure. We, of course, it wouldn't be an issue of Los Angeles Magazine without a best something. So we the top 10 Italian restaurants in Los Angeles, which don't look a lot like what the Italian restaurants looked like 20 years ago. You know, we did white tablecloth well. Now, sort of the best Italian restaurants are the same places where you can, like, throw your kid in a high chair, get a really good Negroni, have to scream at your neighbor over the sort of, like, lively din. But they're casual and they're joyful. One of my favorite restaurants in the entire city. It's where I sent my dad for his 70th birthday. It's where my husband wants to go on his birthday, is Soto on Pico, which is Steve Sampson, just doing delicious, what used to be a bit more religiously Southern Italian. And he's sort of loosened up a little bit as the restaurant's been, you know, I think approaching maybe even 5 years old. So now you can also, you know, taste some things from the North, and they have this beautiful wine list, but the sort of Neapolitan pizzas, nobody does it like that. It's still beautiful. Everything you get is one of those dishes that you put in your mouth and the room sort of goes quiet and you need a moment to just feel it. It's very emotional food in a wonderful way. In fact, the man who used to be manning the pizza oven there is the man who is helming the kitchen at what we deemed the number one Italian restaurant in Los Angeles, also a newcomer, Alimento, which is in Silver Lake. And Zach Pollock, who was the chef at Soto, is there putting out sort of very unique, his own very particular unique riff on Italian classics.
One of the restaurants that you've highlighted, I think it's number two, is it's Union, which I think that so many people haven't tried yet because it's out there in Pasadena and people really need to get in their cars and drive.
Yes, out there in Pasadena, unless you're me, and I fortunately live very close to Pasadena. Bruce Coleman, I think, is such a passionate chef. He has a remarkable way with pasta. In fact, elsewhere in this issue, we tackle all the beautiful handmade pastas you can get in Los Angeles now. And Bruce is going to be opening Need & Co. Pasta Bar at Grand Central Market, where he'll be making some of the pastas that they serve at Union. And I say that he sort of represents a cultural apex in Los Angeles for handmade pasta. He's infusing a lot with various sort of powders, and like there's something that had like arugula powder in it that he uses to make things and beet. And of course, there's squid ink and there's little pockets. But it's not just, you know, what Bruce is going to be doing is huge, but Taroni makes an insane amount of pastas by hand, you know, and you have Factory Kitchen.
Yeah, Factory Kitchen is making corzetti, which you are so labor intensive because they're like little discs
and
that are then stamped.
You stamp them.
They're like stamped with a logo or something to give it ridges.
Yes, and then there's also like these huge giant ribbons of soft pasta. But there are also some like semolina artisanal pasta, which is a local woman who's making them for retail, and you can buy them at various fancy shops. I know at Need in Grand Central Market, you're going to be able to sit there, watch them make your sort of beet tortelletti while you sip a Nebbiolo, and then can buy some to take home later to make it home.
The complete Italian experience.
It's going to be pretty great. I'm excited about it.
Yeah. So, you know, it's so funny because we think about really dining well and sitting down and having a great plate of pasta or a really beautifully made meat dish served to us, maybe a whole branzino. But the Italian deli is just something that often gets lost in LA because we don't have a Little Italy.
We don't. You know, there's remnants of where there was one sort of around the Chinatown area. And actually, Eastside Market Italian Deli is one of the last ones that's still there, that's been open since 1929, that's still in that area serving Italian food. But yeah, there was a sort of great diaspora of Italian delis and Italian markets that went a lot to the San Gabriel Valley, some to the West Side. The most famous that most of us know is Bay Cities in Santa Monica, because they serve that delicious godmother sandwich that everyone adores, including me. But there's still these little mom-and-pop shops, and in many cases, we discovered that, you know, they may not be owned even by the same family, but an employee that worked there for 30 years took over because they loved it so much and couldn't, you know, let it go. But they're spread throughout the entire city. Leslie Bala, who is a writer you've had on the program and who wrote this story for us and reported it, she went out to Claro's, which is in San Gabriel, in the San Gabriel Valley, and she went while she was there, and she snapped a picture of Rosario Mazzeo, who is this guy who, if you ever come in for the sandwich, they just call it the sandwich, he's there. He's been working there, I think, more than 60 years, claims to have never taken a day off, stands behind that meat slicer, cranking out sandwiches day in and day out. You know, he keeps a bottle of Sicilian olive oil under the counter just for regulars that he will only sell them if you ask for it. You know, it's wonderful, and there still is this huge, strong Italian culture that exists in these places, and they're beautiful and they're cute, and you can usually get a really good sandwich.
Okay, let's talk about red sauce.
Mm-hmm.
There is someone who you call the marinara maestro.
Yes, which actually he would probably not be pleased that we're calling him the marinara maestro because he is so not a red sauce guy. You may have heard of him. His name is Jimmy Kimmel. He is without a doubt the most enthusiastic gastronome I think I've ever met. Also happens to have a late night show. But I honestly think in his mind that is secondary to his passion for all things food. But I talked to him. You know, he's Italian-American. And his uncle, actually, who was on the show for a long time, was Frank Sinatra's bodyguard at Caesar's Palace. And, you know, they go way back. But he also loves to cook. He makes his own vinegars. He grinds his own flour for his own pizza dough that he makes. He grows his own San Marzanos that he uses to make his own marinara, which we run the recipe of here. He has a pizza oven in his backyard.
Why haven't I met this guy?
He also has two sous vide machines in his office. So, but Italian, I think, is where his heart is. And he impressed me. He put me to shame, honestly, in terms of food.
Well, Leslie, thank you so much for another insane edition of Los Angeles Magazine.
Don't you mean grazie?
Grazie.
Prego.
Leslie Barger-Suter is the dine editor for Los Angeles Magazine. The Food Lover's Guide to Italian Eats is on newsstands now. If you missed any part of today's show, you can listen anytime you want at kcrw.com, via iTunes, or anywhere you download podcasts. You can also find good food on demand on KCRW's smartphone apps. Thanks to everyone who works on Good Food. That's Jillian, Camelia, Laryl, Ronnie, and Gary. I'm Evan, and I'll be back next week with more good food.